May it please the court. Injury, by definition, means treatment. You have an injury, you should be treated for it. The plaintiffs, appellees, in their brief on page 4, notes that is her contention in her complaint that had she been treated at the appropriate time in March of 2005, she would not have needed further aggressive treatments. Plaintiff in her brief acknowledges she should have been treated in March of 2005, acknowledges, therefore, there was an injury in March of 2005, thereby substantiating everything the defense has been said. Dunn and Meekins clearly apply, and the legislative gymnastics, which the plaintiff would have this court go through, are not needed. It's really a simple case looked at in that manner. I would also submit to you that U.S. v. Anderson absolutely applies. Now, the court understands what U.S. v. Anderson is about, and I won't repeat it in detail. But I will note, with respect to the lower court dealt with U.S. v. Anderson and did not consider applicable because, as stated in footnote 66 of the opinion below, that the court had not received any evidence that Plaintiff Meyer received an increased risk of harm as a result of the alleged negligence. That would make sense for two reasons. Of course, the court didn't get it. One, if I submitted an affidavit, we'd have counter-affidavits and it'd be an automatic issue of fact, as was pointed out in the oral argument below. Two, Mr. Dalton, in his wisdom, being an excellent attorney, didn't plead it, and therefore it wasn't necessary or could be brought to the court. But U.S. versus Anderson absolutely provided this plaintiff a remedy within the time frame without needing to go through what needed to be done. I would like to note that this is not a situation where an otherwise diligent plaintiff has been rendered and has suffered a hardship because of the statutory interpretation of our statute of limitations based on Dunn and Meekins. In this particular case, the alleged negligent act occurred on March 8, 2005. When the physician allegedly misread a mammogram. In the Harris affidavit, which is attached in two separate parts in the record, B10 is what I'm referring with, Dr. Harris notes that he would not have been able to give an opinion on the causation aspect, quote, before the lymph nodes became involved, close quote. That's known in paragraph 8 of the Harris affidavit. If you go to paragraph 7 of the Harris affidavit, it states that 3 out of 14 lymph nodes were positive when she was diagnosed in May 2006. That means the lymph nodes were involved in May 2006, and by the Harris affidavit, he could have given his affidavit of merit shortly thereafter. Mrs. Meyer was clearly aware of her cancer because in July 7th of 06, she began preoperative chemotherapy. So by any standard, she had awareness. The statute of limitations, as we would argue, expired in May of 07, almost 10 months, giving plaintiff almost a 10-month leeway to do what she needed to do. It's a fact of this case that this plaintiff did not seek Mr. Dalton's assistance until September 2007. Long after the Harris affidavit could have been submitted, long after the statute was run. This is a case where a plaintiff unfortunately sat on her rights, and I say that factually, not critically, as a result of which an effort is being made to turn what I consider to be the good Delaware law inside out in order to save this plaintiff.
Can you comment on the hypothetical in the amicus brief DTLA, if a woman returns for a routine screening mammogram 2 years to the date of the initial screening, was misinterpreted, and on that day learns at 4:45 p.m. she has metastatic breast cancer, she's presumed to have knowledge of the negligent act within the two-year limitation, and then the claim expires minutes later.
That's the nightmare that any plaintiff's attorney has run into versus, and that's doesn't deal with the affidavit of merit. That deals with whether Dunn is or is good, not good law, whether it's fair or unfair. Because under that scenario, they would have about 45 minutes to get something together. Having said that, it would be a hardship, but statute of limitations are, by definition, ones that produce hardships. And furthermore, the plaintiff's method of calculating doesn't relieve this person necessarily, because it could be that the expert witness looking at this would say, yeah, it was already metastatic at that point. This is what the plaintiff's bar, what DTLA would have the court do, is simply say Dunn is bad law because it works a hardship. When, if you look at the Dunn case, that particular plaintiff did have a hardship incur upon, I can't remember off the top of my head, it was a him or a her. And this court said statutes do this from time to time. In addition to the fact, the General Assembly has had, since the 70s, the opportunity to legislatively overrule Dunn and Meekins and its progeny, and has chosen not to do it. In fact, as recently as the Leatherberry case, Your Honors basically said that the statute, the commission, and the preamble of the act were cited with approval in that there's the certainty that requires it. Statutes, by definition, are harsh. If Your Honor were to extend, hypothetically, the statute of limitations saying, we will, for this person, give someone an extra, pick a date, six months, then if it occurred 2 years and 6 months down the road. That type of hypothetical means there can never be a statute.
And you referred to the opportunity of the legislature to act. Do we know, or do you know, what the actual historical record is? Has legislation been introduced that's died in committee? Has no legislation been introduced?
The answer to that question is, I don't know. I don't know either way. The only thing I do know from personal experience is some of the history behind the Affidavit of Merit statute, because I was involved in that, and that's just a personal representation. There's nothing in the record. But the answer to your question is whether there's ever been an effort to do that. No, there is actually, yes, there was an effort a long time ago for somebody to, there was a bill introduced to radically change the Delaware statute of limitations of medical negligence, but it was because some particular individual plaintiff was very angry and got his or her legislature to introduce it. And it went nowhere. And I don't think that's good legislative history, because it doesn't indicate legislative intent. That was just a legislator keeping a client at bay who was angry. And the court can draw no conclusions from that, even though it frankly helps us. So that's the only information I can give on that aspect of it. The touchstone of the Delaware statute of limitations is certainty. Now, in his excellently worded brief, Mr. Dalton points to many states in which they have focused on certain aspects of their law and has pointed out the various differences between Delaware and the other states. I would note that most of these states probably didn't have the preamble that Delaware has and probably did not have the commission finding that Delaware has. But most importantly, what I think the court will find, if you look hard into these statutes and opinions, you will see that what the court was doing in all of these cases, it was taking a very unstructured, amorphous, hard to figure out when statutes begin and don't begin, and saying, this is what we're going to do to make the statute of limitations something with some certainty to it. In that regard, contrary to what the plaintiff has to say, in that Delaware should catch up with the other states, I submit it's just a flip, and that Delaware has, as is often the case, been the leader among the states. And as long ago as our statute, as interpreted by Dunn and eventually Meekins, Delaware has said, this is what we're going to do. We are going to make these certain, and we are going to make it clear that this is the way it handles. The only, up to this point, true, quote-unquote, inroad in the certainty has been the Ewing versus Beck line of opinions, but even those have certainly attached to them, because you can figure out the statute from the actual medical record of the actual plaintiff themselves. You don't have to go to an outside independent expert witness, as the plaintiffs are contending you should do in this case, and thereby hold the Delaware statute limitations statutory scheme hostage to an outside person. Let me give this example, if I might. Plaintiff patient goes to a doctor with a lump. The doctor says, you have a spider bite. Here are the antibiotics. The doctor's wrong. It's Lyme disease. Different antibiotics for Lyme disease. By the time this mistake has been figured out, the infection has seeded. where Lyme disease often does, into the bones. The plaintiff has bad knees, perhaps a bad back, needs back reconstruction, artificial knees, etc. Sued for malpractice. When does it begin? Clearly on the date of the misdiagnosis, or if you have a Ewing versus Beck situation, it may be extended beyond 2 years, but you can definitively picture what would happen and figure out based on the medical records of the patient himself or herself. Same patient, same doctor, same misdiagnosis of spider bite, but it's not a spider bite. It's a sarcoma, which is a type of cancer that can appear as a lump. Now, if you adopt the plaintiff's argument here, we don't know when the statute of limitations is going to begin until some independent outside expert for hire comes in and tells us, which means the legislative certainty of statute of limitations as set forth in the preamble of the Act, as set forth in the commission report, as verified in Leatherbury, is gone. And through the back door, the policy of the state of Delaware has been uptipped, which the court has not had the opportunity to do through the front door on this affidavit of merit issue, which has been argued by the plaintiffs. I would note that in this particular case, which I think was brought on oral argument below, is Dr. Harris was asked by Mr. Dalton, how about November 1, 2005? Is that going to do the trick? And that was a plaintiff-chosen date. No disrespect. He's a man of complete integrity. We've litigated against each other for over 20 years, doing what he's supposed to do for his client. But isn't it curious that if the date had been chosen by Mr. Dalton and the doctor 10 days earlier, then by that affidavit, the statute would have still been missed? This brings into the courtroom independent outside experts telling us when statutes run. It would mean that, for example, in the scenario that I just gave you, if there were two different patients, the doctor sees one patient at 10 o'clock in the morning and that patient's care is rendered by one statute, one interpretation, which doesn't need an expert outside opinion, and 4 hours later a patient comes in and it's the same issue, but now we're governed by and held hostage to the outside expert. Statute of limitations shouldn't be a matter of expert witnesses. Now, I grant you that there have been cases where the judge has said to the jury, you need to decide a fact on whether the statute will or will not run. The Bissell case is the perfect example, which was cited. And the Bissell case, the issue there was whether or not mammograms in 1988 and 1989 were discrete, separate, or were they part of a continuum? I was in the Bissell case. So was Mr. Robbins, I see in the back here. And that, what you don't know and you can't tell from that case is, and I have nothing to back it up but my own anecdotal experience, in that particular case, the radiologist was such a horrible witness and so thoroughly despised by the jury, which we later found out at a Judge Biferato seminar when one of the juries was there, that they were going to find against that radiologist no matter what. And that concerns me because, as I pointed out in my reply brief, if you're going to put statute limitations subject to jury and they have to decide the competing expert witness opinions, you're going to be in a position where the jury is going to be absolutely influenced by some of the emotion of the case. And I can do no more than point to the plaintiff's answering brief where information about how bad she was doing was brought before this court. While it is a shame that Mrs. Meyer has this awful disease, this type of playing to emotion has no part in a legislative analysis, in a statutory construction. So I would submit to your honors that the statutory scheme which is being impressed by the plaintiff is unnecessary for the reasons stated, is contrary to well-settled Delaware law, contrary to the intention of the makers of the statute, something that should be done directly and not through the back door, and based on the Anderson case, isn't even needed. And with that, I know I'm cutting in a little bit of rebuttal, and I will quit now and reserve the remainder for later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. No one ever died of cancer in their breast. It doesn't happen. People die when cancer moves. People die when cancer moves first regionally and then distantly. People don't die of cancer in their breast. What we have asked the court to do, the lower court, and we ask this court to affirm, is that the date of the injury is the date of an injury. To go back to what counsel has recently said about my complaint, yes, we did allege that if she were treated earlier, she wouldn't have had an injury. She would have had cancer. She had cancer before the misdiagnosis. She had cancer on the day of the misdiagnosis. And she had cancer the day after the misdiagnosis. She had an injury from the misdiagnosis at a later time. I absolutely concede that I went to an expert to decide whether to file this case. And I asked the expert after his review, and you've seen how the expert reviewed this in his CV. Within a reasonable degree of medical probability, doctor, can you tell me more likely than not, did this cancer metastasize before or after November 1st? I picked the date because I had to decide whether, consistent with my Rule 11 obligations, I should file this case. And based on the answer from the expert, I did. The idea that somehow statutes of limitations, issues of fact or law, should be somehow sacrosanct regarding facts regarding statutes of limitations as opposed to liability or causation eludes me. I don't know why that there is such a problem with dealing with expert opinion in this area when we deal with it in all other areas of the law, and especially all other areas of malpractice law. The defendant in this case tries to make out the fact, tries to state that the trial court somehow confused the factual and medical, as they state, definition of injury with the legal definition of injury. I don't know what the difference is between the factual, medical, and legal definition, or whether there even should be, because there shouldn't be a different definition of these three on these three aspects. Five states have looked at this, a statute just like Delaware's, or very much like Delaware's. I mean, this defense brief maintains that no one of those states said it's from the time the injury was sustained as opposed to when the injury occurred. I could not follow that argument. Those states were very much like ours, and every one of those states said, well, of course, in a failure to diagnose case, the time of the negligence and the time of the injury are simply two different times. They're two different times. Now, most medical malpractice cases have to deal with injury that is contemporaneous to the negligence. That's the vast majority of medical malpractice cases. But in failure to diagnose cases, they are never the same. Seven states, as the amicus from the AMA point out, seven states have statutes that are different from Delaware. They're fundamentally different from Delaware because they say that the statute of limitations runs from the date of the negligence or from the date of the wrongful act or from the date of the malpractice. Fine. Those states can have that law despite the fact that it's our contention that those states have laws that are constitutionally invalid. Different issue. The defense brief maintains that we are trying to be violative of Dunn and say that the injury is from the time of when the injury manifests itself, the time of manifestation. Well, no, that's not the case at all. See, we're maintaining in the first instance, at least, that the time of injury should control. Why? Because that's what the statute says. The time of injury in a case like this is the time when the cancer moves, not when the cancer is discovered. That cancer's been in Ms. Meyer's body for several years. Some people would say five, four, three. It's a medical issue. And that cancer didn't change the day after as opposed to the day before. And so to somehow define that negligence equals injury to the plaintiff is a misapplication of the law in our view.
Have you... Or can you ascertain whether or not the legislature has addressed this in any form since our decisions?
No, Your Honor, I cannot. I know of no other way. I had heard the same story that Mr. Elzafon had heard, but other than that, no, I don't believe it has, other than the affidavit of merit legislation. Okay. You know, the delay in this case creates the negligence. The delay creates the potential for injury. As the DTLA brief notes in some of the literature it cited, that injury may never occur. the body may fight off that tumor. We may never have an injury, or we may. But in either event, the delay, the misdiagnosis on the day of the mammogram, that didn't injure the plaintiff. That caused a delay which created a potential for injury. And now should we say that Delaware, which stands alone, there is no state in the union that has a statute that says from the date of the injury, yet somehow defines that as the date of the negligence. There is no other state that holds that. So can we now say that our legislature, fundamentally, can we say that our legislature intended to keep people like Catherine Meyer from being able to preserve her rights? Did, in this case, because when we look at this, we look at these, the commission, we have placed so much emphasis on one thing that the commission was looking to do in the preamble. They didn't want the time of discovery rule. That much is clear. We get that. But what they also say here, and it's never mentioned in any of the briefs, they also said is they wanted to make sure that people had their rights to access to the courts. They wanted to make sure that people were compensated who were injured. That was another legislative intent that we don't hear about. Well, if we have, the legislature always has to deal with competing interests. We understand that and respect it. But it does no violence to the legislative scheme. It does no violence to the statute as written to say, simply to state the fact. And the fact is that in this small group of cases, in a failure to diagnose case, the date of the negligence and the date of the injury are simply two different dates. And every court that has looked upon that in Iowa and Nevada and Virginia and Arizona and Maryland have all agreed with that basic fact that they're two different dates.
Are you going to comment on U.S. versus Anderson?
I am. I'd be happy to do it now, actually. Anderson doesn't apply in this case. Anderson is a rule. Anderson is a matter of damages. In the Anderson case, we had an unfortunate gentleman with a scrotal mass. Because of the delay, he was able to file a lawsuit which showed that, one, there was negligence, two, there was causation, the causation being that he needed two surgeries and chemotherapy that he would not have needed had he been properly diagnosed originally. So the issue was then, could he have another element of damages applied? That element of damages meaning that he had 100% chance of cure, if there is actually such a thing, but he had 100% chance of cure had he been treated at the right time, but now he has an 85% chance of cure, excuse me. That 15% increase in risk, can he get additional damages for that? And the court said, yes, he could. In fact, if you look in the Superior Court pattern jury instructions, where this is not a loss of chance, this is an increased risk of harm. If you look at the Superior Court pattern jury instructions, the instruction on this is properly placed under damages. Catherine Myers' issue at all. We didn't have causation in March of 2005. So it doesn't apply.
Compensate for injury, don't they?
Damages compensate for injury, yes, according to Anderson now, after you've already established liability and causation. And in Anderson, the causation was the increased surgery and the increased treatment caused by the delay. So you also get another measure of damages for increased risk. But the increased risk is a level for damages after you've already proven a case. So we don't believe Anderson applies under that circumstance because my client asks that the time of the injury, meaning the metastases, is what the statute applies to. 2 years from the time of the injury, the time of the injury being the metastases here. Now, my client is still under a significant risk of her disease going from a regional metastases to a distant metastases. If it does, it will kill her. Her chances of survival have gone from, when it's regional, if it goes to distant, she really won't have a chance of survival. And that's what she's dealing with. But when did the injury occur under by expert testimony? The injury occurred at the time of the metastases. And what do the experts in cancer tell us, as Dr. Harris's clearly an expert in cancer. What he says is it's too speculative to say that delay in and of itself without the movement to the regional lymph nodes, without the metastases, it's medically speculative. I can't make that call. So not all delays are the same. That's just the point here. Catherine Meyer.
What point do you think Mr. Elzafan was trying to make when he said in May of 2006 four of the lymph nodes were involved?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
I said, what do you think Mr. Elzafan is trying to convey to us by saying in May of 2006 four of the lymph nodes were involved, according to Dr. Harris?
Yes, sir. What I think he's trying to say is that the plaintiffs in this case are trying to use a time of discovery rule, which is not the case. Dr. Harris looked at the lymph nodes. He looked at the lymph nodes under slides, got the pathology slides, and said based on the, and he says this in his affidavit, based on the tumor load, the amount of cancer in those lymph nodes, that it's my opinion that those lymph nodes did not start to become infected, wrong word, supplied with cancer cells until after November 1st. I think the defendant's position is any delay means an injury, and that we're trying to maintain a time of discovery. Now, we have a separate argument on time of discovery, but the trial court did not decide this on time of discovery, and my client does not need time of discovery to have this. We want time of injury because that's what the statute says. I hope I've answered your question, but I'm not sure I completely understood the defendant's position on this, other than to say.
Well, as I understood his position, he's saying that the spreading was manifest by looking at the four lymph nodes that Dr. Harris referred to in his affidavit. And you seem to be suggesting that, notwithstanding the fact the lymph nodes were implicated, it's not an indication that there had already been a spreading.
No, once the cancer gets to the lymph node, a fortiori, there is a spread. The question is, what was the timing of the spread? And the timing of the spread was sometime after November. Now, I think this is an important point, because we're not talking about, when we're talking about time of injury being November, we're not talking about time of manifestation. Because time of manifestation is when the plaintiff knows or should know. That's time of manifestation could also be called time of discovery, when I know or should know that it happened. We're not asking for that in the first instance here.
Well,
we're asking
just tell us, what do you think Dr. Harris was saying in his affidavit when he referred to these four lymph nodes in the context of May 2006? What was his point?
His point was that if the lymph nodes were as they were in May of 2006, based on his knowledge, that it is unlikely that before November of 2005 that they had been implicated yet. And so, therefore, there wasn't an injury prior to that. He was using growth cycles within the lymph nodes to discern what is the date upon which he believes, within a reasonable degree of medical probability, those lymph nodes first became cancerous.
Right. And,
in other words, time of injury.
So when he looks at the lymph nodes in May of 2006,
yes, sir,
is he seeing an injury or not?
Oh, absolutely seeing an injury.
So that would be within the two-year statute of limitations?
It was definitely within the two-year statute of limitations. She had 10 more months. That's correct.
And that's so consistent with your earlier statement that time of injury is when the cancer moves.
Yes, sir. Time of manifestation is a time of discovery issues is a different issue. We have a constitutional argument based on that, but that's not what that's obviously not where the trial court went, and that's not what we are arguing in the first instance. We are asking for a time of injury analysis because that's what the statute says. We have talked about Dunn and Meekins, and I'd just like to go to Meekins. Because Dunn is somewhat confusing, I think.
Can you help? I mean, one of the things that I keep asking about what the General Assembly did is, you have a rational argument that perhaps those cases should have been decided differently. But they weren't. And the General Assembly is presumed to know how they were decided. And the General Assembly has done nothing to change the decision. So don't we have case law that says that that is indicative that actually they were correctly decided according to the intent of the General Assembly because they've done nothing to correct
them? The court could certainly adopt that. We think that would be wrong. We think it would be wrong because we believe that Dunn and particularly Meekins was wrongly decided. We don't believe that the legislature, do we really think that the legislature intended to keep people like Catherine Myers from access to the courts? Do we really think that's what the legislature intended when they said from the time of the injury? The General Assembly was clearly looking to take away the tail, that they called it, and not have statutes of limitations run on forever. We get that. But that doesn't change the fact that they use the word time of injury. Now, do I believe that the General Assembly then read Meekins and thought it was rightly decided and then decided not to have any further legislation? No, I actually don't believe that happened. But I understand the court's principled position in this. We just disagree with it. Meekins was wrongly decided, in our view, with respect. The fundamental issue in Meekins is that Mary Meekins was allegedly misdiagnosed on December 21st, 1994. The court states that, in its opinion, that had Ms. Meekins found out about that somehow and filed suit based on December 21st or December 22nd or sometime in December, that she would have had a case. However, her damages would have been, I think, speculative or difficult to prove. Simply not correct under our law. Most cases, or many cases, of failure to diagnose cancer are fought on the battleground of liability. All failure to diagnose cancer cases are fought on the battleground of causation. It would not surprise me in this case, because it's happened before to me in these kinds of cases, where liability is admitted. Yeah, we missed it. Causation is never admitted. If I, for some reason, was involved, Mary Meekins asked me to represent her at the end of December of 1994, and I suggested she go to another mammographer, another radiologist, and that mammographer or radiologist said, oh my gosh, you have a cancer here. You better get treated right away. Would I have had a case? There is no possibility that I would have had a case. I would have had liability. Oh yeah. I would not have had causation. It's the difference between poor medical care and malpractice. The case simply didn't exist. And to the extent that it didn't exist then, once the affidavit of merit legislation, which the legislature did pass, which said we have a new requirement, a new and good requirement that we backed. I say we, the DTLA people did. I was involved, and I say this with no great pride maybe every time I read the statute, but I was involved in drafting. Mary Meekins could not have filed her case when the court suggested that she could under the affidavit of merit, and certainly Catherine Meyer could not have filed her case, either under affidavit of merit or Rule 11 circumstances. We can't tell people that because someone missed something that it is clearly a case. It's not a case. It's part of a case. It may be bad medicine, but whether it's malpractice is all determinant on whether there is injury that occurs because of that delay. If there's no injury that occurs, there is no malpractice. The cancer in Catherine Meyer's body was there the day before she went for the mammogram, the weeks before, the months, and probably the years before she went for the mammogram. That cancer was there the months after she had the mammogram. The question is, when did that cancer injure her? Because the defendants are always wont to say in these cases, and appropriately and fairly, we didn't cause the cancer. Of course you didn't. Of course you didn't cause the cancer. But then they turn and say, but the cancer is the injury. Well, how can the cancer be the injury if they didn't cause it in a lawsuit? An injury in a lawsuit only occurs when negligence causes an injury. And negligence did not cause an injury to Catherine Meyer until November of 2005. She filed in October of 2007. She was therefore within the statute of limitations.
With your familiarity of the affidavit of merit legislation, is there anything in any of the synopses, the floor debate, testimony, that would suggest an intent to modify the definition of injury as interpreted by this court?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Bill.
Thank you.
It is incorrect to state that the position by the plaintiff only applies to cancer cases. It would apply to any case, it's not this small group, where the act and the injury are not exactly simultaneous. A surgical error is obvious. But, for example, Dunn wasn't a cancer case. Dunn was a surgery case, and it wasn't apparent right away. You can have, quote, unquote, delays in cancer cases, infectious disease cases, a lot of internal disease cases. Heart attack cases can have delays. Delays are not simply limited to cancer cases. I think we should be clear on that point. Another issue to respond. It is the plaintiff's position, and he said, the injury may never occur. The body's defenses may take over, and the plaintiff may get lucky, and the cancer never spread beyond localized. It can never be regional or distant. We know in this case it became regional in May 2006 per Dr. Harris. But it is, if you follow the plaintiff's argument to their natural conclusion, you wouldn't treat cancer. You would let it go and see what happens. When you have an injury, you treat it. Treatment equals there has to be an injury. Nothing could be clearer. And never could anybody imagine, nor has it been suggested, that if you suspect a cancer, you don't treat it. Of course you treat it, because you want to get the patient better. You want to prevent the regional spread. You want to prevent the distant metastatic spread. And that's exactly what the damages at Anderson says you can go for, because if there is a delay in treatment, maybe you'll caught it, maybe you haven't, and just maybe. And because you don't know, and you have to file something within 2 years per Dunn, Meekin, the court has said, well, this is a way of giving some breathing room to your case, and we will let you plead the increased risk of harm under Anderson. And if it is the case that during the pendency of that litigation, the cancer actually does go beyond that which one thought it would be, then there's an amendment and a relation back. So Anderson absolutely covers this situation. In terms of legislative history that Your Honor has mentioned, I don't know if this helps or hurts either side, but both the Medical Society of Delaware and the DTLA have filed amicus briefs, and they were not able, neither were able to point to legislative history that goes either way. And they would probably be the ones who monitor best because they have a, quote-unquote, vested interest. So that's the best that we can do for Your Honor's question, and whether that may cut both ways, positively or negatively, but that's where we are on that issue. The right to access legislative intent. The defense had never suggested this is not a right of access. The courts have always been open. In fact, I'll go Mr. Dalton one better. I think right of access is constitutional in Delaware as opposed to legislative. But within that framework, our courts have said, and the legislature has adopted, for statute limitations, there must be some degree of certainty. And however it is well argued by my distinguished friend on the right, if the plaintiff's position is adopted, they will be interjected into the Delaware statute of limitations analysis outside experts' opinions. And yes, we do litigate a lot of matters, but not for something like this. We don't want, nor is it should it be the policy of Delaware that the statute of limitations certainty principle, as stated in the preamble to the Act, as stated in the Commission, as stated in Dunn, Meekins, as confirmed by Leatherbury, should be held hostage to expert opinions from outside hired experts on either side. If the Court has no more questions, I've concluded my remarks, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.